You're listening to Toi Manaho, Designers Institute of New Zealand's DCAST, specifically episode 5 of Outside In, No Borders, a series where we explore the lives, perspectives and reflections of a diverse range of New Zealand designers who live and work overseas. My name's Brendan Jarvis, your host and the managing founder of The Space In Between, a behaviour-based design research practice and the home of New Zealand's first and only world-class human-centred design and innovation lab. You can find out more about that and some of the other things we do at thespaceinbetween.co.nz. With me today is our guest, Nandini Nair. Nans, as she prefers to be called, recently completed a Fulbright Science and Innovation Scholarship that she was awarded in 2019. And as part of her scholarship, she earned a Master of Design from the prestigious Carnegie Mellon University. After grad school and until recently, Nans was a senior product designer at Laurel in Los Angeles, a startup that's on a mission to give back time to legal and professional services firms through machine learning and automation. At Laurel, Nans led the design of the internal tools that streamlined how the core features of the product were configured. She also created the design system that made it possible to design and build the product at speed. Winding the clock back, Nans graduated with a Bachelor of Design in Visual Communication from Massey University, after which she started a freelance practice specializing in the design of social and environmental impact projects with clients such as Kogo, Inspiral, Te Huku Media, Inspiring Stories, and Akama. Nans believes that design has the power to address some of the world's greatest challenges. She has a passion for bringing clarity and meaning to ambiguity and complexity, in particular through well-crafted digital experiences. And she's here with me now for this conversation on DCAST. Nans, it's great to have you here and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brendan. Kia ora. It's great to be on the show.
It's great to have you, and I really enjoyed learning all about the amazing things that you've been up to in your career. And one of the things that's most recently happened for you is that you were volunteering at the CHI conference in Hamburg, Germany, as you're making your way back to New Zealand, I understand. So
yes.
for people who aren't familiar with the organization CHI, what is CHI and what is it that called you to volunteer at this conference?
So CHI is the flagship academic conference for a field called human-computer interaction. This year, it was held in Hamburg, and it was a humongous conference. There were around 4,000 academics, PhD students, master's students, and researchers from companies such as Google and Microsoft Research, all gathered to discuss the latest research, the papers that they've written, and run workshops and just basically exchange knowledge about the field of computer interaction design, human computer interaction design. And it was an incredible time. And I think one of the reasons why I really wanted to go to this conference was a way to bookend my Fulbright experience, to understand where we stand in technology, help me figure out where my interests lie in the realm of academia, but also how I could bridge the gaps between my experience in academia as well as what's happening in industry. So volunteering was a really great way to kind of get mixed in with that. Yeah.
Mm. So I get the sense that you may feel like you've still got some unfinished business as far as it relates to academia and the design field in academia.
Yeah. I think I keep having this push and pull with academia and the industry. When I'm in industry, I really yearn for the creativity and flexibility of academia and the research focus. And then when I'm in academia, I really yearn for the practicality and the speed of industry. So it's a little bit of both, and I'm still trying to find how I can create a happy middle between the two and have both of them in my life. So, yeah.
What, if anything, as a result of attending the conference in this context that we've been speaking about here, this sort of caught between two worlds, became clearer for you as a result?
Yeah, I think academia is very, especially in the field of human-computer interaction, HCI, I think is quite concerned at the pace of development of technology, especially with AI and the increasing disparities it's going to create in society, whether it's with, you know, actually replacing the labor force or also the increasing gap between people who understand AI and tech and those who can't, who don't or don't have access. So there were some really interesting conversations that are happening in academia, which I feel like are a good balance to the pace of industry. So I think that came through a lot in the conference.
So let's follow this thread along, but let's go back in time a little and have a conversation about you leaving New Zealand sometime, from what I gather, early to mid-2019 to take on this Fulbright scholarship in science and innovation. And as I mentioned in your introduction, you went to study at a really renowned university, Carnegie Mellon. Now, this is in itself, by itself, a really great achievement. I was curious about the journey there. Like, how did this come to be? You know, this is not an insignificant milestone in your career so far.
Yeah, there was a lot of chance involved in getting the Fulbright. I had heard about a Fulbright at an exhibition, I think, that I'd walked through. I think it was Festival for the Future. And I'd casually talked to them at one of their stalls. And this was when I was really getting into social enterprise and social impact projects in Wellington. And I told them my story about what I'm interested in and what I work on. And they had said they hadn't gotten many designers before apply for a Fulbright. And so I said, what do I have to lose? Let me just put my story out there and see if it resonates. And, you know, as it's a scholarship application, you have to write a couple of personal essays, which I did. And I was, lucky enough to get the Science and Innovation Scholarship. This was around 2018 when I found out, and that led me to a process of finding grad schools in the US, shortlisting them, applying, going through that whole process. And in my search, I talked to a lot of people about which university to go to. And resoundingly, I had heard Carnegie Mellon is an R1 research institution. It's where some really innovative work is happening in technology and design and systems thinking. It's the place to go. So yeah, that's how I landed up at CMU.
So you did a Master of Design. What was your core focus? What was your area of inquiry? What was it all about?
Yeah, so the Master's, one of the reasons I chose CMU was because the discipline of transition design that was created by Terry Irving, Cameron Tonkinwise, and Gideon Kossoff emerged from CMU. And it had a real transition design is a discipline that's combining systems thinking, futures thinking, theory of change into a framework for how to think about complex, deep systemic problems and how to start addressing them to transition to a sustainable future. Another kind of field that I explored at CMU was human-computer interaction, which was the conference that I had just gone to. And in it, it was very interesting to learn about design and AI, persuasive design, and overall, I felt like the experience just really expanded what design means for me. And
Well, let's go into that. So, yeah, if you cast your mind back to the NANS that left New Zealand in 2019, mm-hmm. and your view on design then, and if you are to reflect on your journey to this point since you left, you know, sort of three or 4 years later, how would you describe that shift in perspective on design? Like, how has your view on the practice or the field changed as a result of this experience?
Yeah, definitely. So before 2019, I was working with a sustainability startup called Kogo. It used to be called Conscious Consumers, and it was looking at how to use data to reduce the information asymmetry between consumers and businesses who want to change towards more sustainable and ethical practices. So my head was really deep in how to use design, how to use data for behavior change. And I was very excited about the possibility of, you know, using technology as a way to enable this sort of collective force. That was a perspective that I had gone into to the Fulbright and gone to CMU with. Through the experience of Carnegie Mellon, I think what I realized was I needed to do a lot of unlearning about what design was. I had a lot of kind of baggage with design, like IDEO's design thinking that I had learned over the course of, you know, the last decade, the 2010s. And so what CMU allowed me to do was really train me in some critical thinking skills. And I feel like I learned design right back from the fundamentals. And so it was a really great opportunity to really reflect on, you know, what design meant. And, you know, I've been a designer since my undergrad days, right? So it was a nice pause in my career to like stop and reflect, but also having been just in a data oriented startup, it really gave me the opportunity to think more broadly about issues around privacy and ethics. Yeah, and just a reflection on like what is the value that design brings, or a designerly approach brings to creating these platforms, these experiences enabled by data, but also you know, bringing the human centeredness back into the equation. And then obviously, like, because it's academia, it can get quite quirky. Then we also talked about like, how do you decenter the human? Like, how can we make it more environmental? So it was really like stretching what does it mean to be a designer? How do you think like a designer beyond the constraints of IDEO's design thinking framework? So I really enjoyed that experience.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned design thinking and IDEO a couple of times. And when people think of what it means to be a designer and the types of things we do in design, and also how we involve people who are not craft practicing designers but may mm-hmm. want to engage in the design process, design thinking is one of those things that first comes to mind. And yeah. You also talked about there the shift away from human-centeredness into perhaps considering other stakeholders, including the environment in the practice. Mm-hmm. So on that note, it sounds like you're perhaps no longer the biggest fan of design thinking, and that perhaps your perspective has shifted somewhat.
Yeah. I definitely think the branding of design thinking it was great in one way to democratize the process of design, but I think it has also done some harm. And we don't often talk so much about it, but I feel like designers probably need to start owning up to that as well. And so I've been really, you know, I read a lot of critiques of design thinking during my time at grad school. So there is some value in how design happens, but I think there also needs to be the openness for many different approaches to design. So I'm a huge fan of Arturo Escobar's Designs for the Pluriverse, and really understanding how, you know, design already manifests in many different ways. It's not always called design. So yeah, I have a feeling that, you know, design as an industry or even as a discipline has come to a point where we're starting to really acknowledge the many different ways in which it can happen. So I'm hoping design thinking also stretches in the future.
Mm. Now, I don't profess to be an expert at all in this, and I certainly am not as well read as you are. But from what I understand, there is some criticism that design thinking in particular brings mm-hmm. an overly westernized lens to the practice of design, and mm-hmm. has at some in some cases perhaps not been as kind to the experiences of the people that designers have been designing for, and I use that emphasis on for intentionally. What have the critiques that you've connected with the most on design thinking and perhaps some of our other related modern westernized design practices, what have they been? You know, what are the things that you've been exposed to, or the perspectives or the critical thinking that you've done that have changed the way that you think about how you want to practice design in the future?
Yeah, I think I could answer that question in a few different ways. So, I mean, there's obviously the big D design that designers like you and I do because this is our profession. But I think there is a lot of design that happens at an everyday basis in communities by individuals who are, you know, hacking their way through life in a way that isn't designed. I mean, hacking their way in a world that isn't designed for them. And I would say that is also design. So I feel like some of the critiques around the Western idea of design is really kind of pointing a finger at this big D design, where designers come into communities, come into problem spaces, and then dictate, you know, what a solution might be. I think the reflection that needs to happen or is happening more recently is around, actually, there is tacit knowledge in communities, in people, in themselves, in how they solve problems. And if it's, you know, if design is essentially problem solving, then how do we recognize those ways? How do we, you know, acknowledge that that is design in themselves? And how do we value that and celebrate and respect that as well, I think is the change that we need to see. Some of the, I'm trying to think if there are other critiques that come to mind. One of the, one of the kind of shifts that we've seen in design, you know, has gone from design for a user or a community to design with. And I think the next shift that's going to happen or is happening already is design by communities themselves. And so I'm loving this tension that's coming up these days around co-design, around participatory design, in questioning the role of the designer, and in also, you know, bringing questions of who has the power to make decisions, and essentially designing is decision making. So, I'm loving the critiques and conversations that are happening in that space now.
To ground this for people across the wider spectrum of design practice, what is something that you've taken from your time engaging with the academic level, if you like, or the academic critique of design that you've been able to bring down into your daily practice as a product designer? Has there been something that you have put in place already from this time at Carnegie Mellon that you feel is making a difference to how inclusive your design practice is or the directional trajectory of that practice?
So now that I know about potential harms that certain design decisions can enable, now that I know that design is political, now that I know that design has the ability to really, you know, impact a person's life, I think I try and be more careful about how I'm designing. I've become a much slower designer than I used to be. I used to be one of those designers who could turn things around very quickly and, deliver on something. But now I really do take some time to see if wherever possible, and often I do get some pushback around how to make something accessible, you know, just by meeting basic accessibility standards, but also around, you know, even in the mocks, how do we use more inclusive names? How do we design forms that are, accessible and inclusive to everybody? But more so, I'm also interested in the design process, in acknowledging that one of the hardest things to do, especially in a startup, is getting alignment on what our goals are, what our priorities are. So I use my facilitation skills to be able to bring people together to the table and leave their kind of building brain or analytical brain out of the meeting and come with a design brain and acknowledging that they are part of the design process as well. So it's not always an easy process. It's sometimes a real uphill battle that I face. And, you know, I know designers always have that struggle with advocating for design in startups and companies. So I try wherever I can in product teams. But then I think part of it is also like my experience in a community of practice, right? Like I'm part of this network called the Design Justice Network. I used to run this meetup in Wellington called How Might We Do Good. which was a meetup for designers to come and talk about, you know, issues around inclusion and ethics in design. So I feel like there's an opportunity for stuff to happen outside of the job that you do as well. So, yeah.
Well, it certainly sounds like this path that you're on, you've been able to progress some of your thinking and your practice, and it's great to be able to bring some of those insights and stories to the design community that are listening to this today. I wanted to perhaps wind back the clock even a little bit more and just touch on this really strong feeling that I'm getting that you're someone who's quite clearly deeply committed to creating a positive social impact. You even mentioned there in terms of the how might we do good meetup and other things that you've done outside of your day-to-day job. Where does this commitment come from? You know, where does this, you know, this spark, who lit the spark for this fire that's clearly burning? You know, what is it about this particular avenue of design that it seems like you feel called to practice in this way?
Yeah, I believe the spark came when I was a teenager, maybe 19, 20 years old, and I had first learned about climate change and being quite shocked and depressed that this was what was happening in our world. And at the same time, I had met some really incredible climate activists in Wellington. And I had met this community of people called Inspiral who were looking to use their skills, their practical skills. So, you know, this was a group of like engineers, software engineers, designers, lawyers, tech folks, basically, who were thinking about, you know, what are ways that we can leverage our skills to actually do something good and address difficult problems like climate change. And I remember my undergrad thesis project was on, you know, how using information design to understand climate science. I feel like that has been an emphasis, and it's lasted a long time, and I've explored through design in many ways and working with different communities around how to address that. And I think, yeah, I think it will last for a longer time. And it's always a struggle, I think, with being a digital designer to find work that aligns with your values, especially around, I feel like there is a lot of technology and startups out there that are about extraction rather than providing value or really solving problems. And so it's a tricky space to navigate, but I'm really hopeful for the future that, you know, my values and my vocation will align.
And now I want to talk about one of those expressions of your values and vocation that I feel is relevant. And that is, I'd asked you to send me through a picture of some work that you really valued, you know, one that you were particularly proud of or you felt represented who you were really well. And you sent me a photo of a project called Life Kit. So tell me about that. What is it that image represents to you? And why was it the one that you chose out of all the things that you could have sent me?
Yeah, a Life Kit was one of those projects that has really left a mark on me. I think it was a good blend of trying to address a systemic problem at an opportune moment, but also on a practical side, it was a way for me to really understand what it means to do design research. And yeah, so I can give you a bit of a background. So LifeKit is actually a grad student project. It was a collaboration with three of my peers in grad school, Michelle Chow, Anna Boyle, and Yusinia Danielik. And it had started in January 2020. And we were given a prompt to design for life. And it was a prompt given by an organization in Denmark called the Index Project. And we kind of wanted to flip that on its head. And we decided to design for death, or explore the idea of death and dying and end of life and see what opportunities are there. And in that process, I think we realized, you know, what an incredibly rich area it is as a problem space to design for. But what happened was, come March 2020, we're right in the middle of our project. The pandemic hits and this people were really thinking about, you know, their own mortality. The idea of death was very prevalent. And so our topic, our project topic kind of took on another meaning and it became very, very relevant to that time of crisis. So I think the image that I sent you was just, a mockup of an application that we came, you know, that we ended up as our intervention for, end of life planning. And it brought together, it was a solution that brought together concepts around how people feel about their own personal end of life. And of course, it's very diverse, but one of the points of research that we did led to, you know, it being a very personal experience. It's not something that people necessarily want to share with even their family or their communities. So that that process of end of life planning had to be very personal and it had to be done piece by piece because it's actually very overwhelming. So we created, you know, this design solution that was using AI to prompt people at different life milestones that they had in order to start planning for things like a will or a power of attorney or even something like what happens if your, you know, if something happens to you, what do you do with your pet? Who gets the pet? Like somebody needs to make that, you need to make that decision. So like, how do you start slowly prompting people with some of these really hard, difficult decisions when it's often a topic that they don't want to engage in. So it was one of those projects that I felt was very life affirming. You know, we used a lot of very creative research methods with people in retirement homes. We talked to palliative care doctors and social workers, and we really kind of tried to get to the depth of like, you know, how to enable this kind of planning and how do we do it dynamically across a person's lifetime. That was a project that is close to my heart.
You mentioned the timing in particular with the pandemic taking hold.
Yeah.
And just how front of mind the topic of death was and how, well, if I think about my own experience, considering, you know, the unknown at that time and just how confronting those thoughts were. You spoke to a range of people, it sounded like there, in terms of people in rest homes, in terms of the people that care for people at end of life. What story or memory strikes you the most or sticks with you the most from those conversations? Was there any particular conversation that took you to a place as a designer that you didn't expect to find yourself in?
I think one of the things that really stuck out to me was this idea. There were two things. One of them was this idea of time. And I don't think I really appreciated how people experience time as a factor to consider in design. And, you know, we had done some interesting kind of design research methods on asking people about their life, like in the long arc of their life, when do they think they might pass? When do they think they might retire? And it was really interesting to even have people do that exercise and to reflect on like what it means to spend their lifetime. And so I think thinking about time and people's time is an interesting tool in design research. And I think I would love to explore that a little bit more. And essentially in the startup that I was working at, Laurel, we were looking at this idea of time and reclaiming time and, you know, the idea of a time, like understanding, having time awareness. So I definitely think time is a really interesting space. And I think another aspect specifically on the topic of end of life planning was around when a crisis happens, it's already too late. So how do you enable people to be proactive is actually a very, very hard challenge. And, you know, a lot of these complex design challenges around health and fitness you know, addresses this issue of like, how do you do something proactively for your life so that you can have peace of mind later on? You know, this phrase, peace of mind, kept coming up as something that people would want to have with regards to end of life planning. And, you know, we even talked to folks who were very prepared, and they had, you know, parents who were very prepared. And even then, it was such a struggle to get through some of the logistical aspects of end of life for the community. So I think, the connectedness of an issue like this was also really interesting to explore. I think we went into this topic with a very open viewpoint on like where the problems actually exist and who are experiencing the problems. And so I think there's something to say around, you know, who is the real user of a particular project or a product or a platform. Yeah, it needs, you know, you kind of need to be open-minded, because there might be an opportunity in a secondary user that is actually very compelling. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're doing this research in the context of America during the pandemic.
Yes.
And I only have an outside-in perspective into this based on the media that I was consuming at the time, and looking at what looked like to me a very chaotic and disorganized approach to managing such an epic human event. Mm. And I was curious about your perspective as an Indian New Zealander arriving in the US in 2019, when there's not only a pandemic going on, there's also a racial reckoning going on with the death of George Floyd and the subsequent protests that we saw erupt all over that country.
Yeah.
From your point of view on the ground, what was that like? You know, what was it like being immersed in this culture that's quite clearly, well, this is my projection, quite clearly different to the culture that you were used to during such a critical and inflammatory time?
Oh, wow. 2020 was a real experience. So alongside the Life Crit project, I was actually working on a transition design project as well. And this was around, the project was around the racial inequalities and inequities in Pittsburgh. So Carnegie Mellon is based in Pittsburgh, and it has, it has a significant Black population that essentially has, you know, a lot of systemic problems, because it's one of those very old steel mill cities that has, went through a depression and is slowly kind of finding its feet as a city, but has also got a lot of poverty and a lot of systemic issues, such as Black women's maternal mortality rates are one of the worst in the country. And so I was researching with another team these issues around racial inequality, and really educating myself around like what were some of the issues in the country and how did they come about. And we were doing a lot of causal mapping analysis, and, you know, we were doing huge timelines of like, when did this racial inequality actually start, to like understand what were some of the root causes. And at the same time, one of the phases of transition design is also thinking about the future. So like, you know, imagining a future and then casting back to find that transition pathway. And I remember, you know, we had talked about in our project, this was around between Jan and May before George Floyd happened. I think George Floyd happened towards the end of May or early June. We had written, we had presented a future in which the next president of, you know, in the future was going to be a Black woman from Pittsburgh who grew up in the public education system. And, you know, this was a future that enabled, that had all the right things in place for her to become the president of the United States. And in that, you know, planning of the future, we had talked a little bit about Black Lives Matter. And it was just this niche thing that we knew that had happened in the past, but may have an opportunity to like increase the conversation about racial equality in the States. And we were completely shocked when the George Floyd protests happened, not only because we hadn't imagined that, you know, here was a group of designers who were thinking about what a future could look like. We hadn't imagined the impact of how something like Black Lives Matter, the way in which it's spread across the world. And, you know, of course, I went to some of the protests as well. The way in which it really opened and brought to surface this conversation around equity and discrimination. And we were just, you know, completely blown away that was the thing that led to this. And at the same time, we were also having these reckonings and conversations around racial equality in the School of Design, in the university, around, hey, you know, this is one of a very prestigious university in a city that's declining. What can, you know, how is the university playing a role in the city? But also, you know, how come we don't have any Black students in the School of Design? You know, so this conversation was so layered in this experience that I was having. I think the positive that I'd like to mention is I recently saw the Barbie movie trailer, and it's a movie that's coming out soon. And in that, there's a president and she's a Black, you know, she's a Black Barbie. And I'm just like, that's so interesting that these ideas that we have can actually like change reality. Yeah, I feel like 2020 was really a time for like, yeah, reflecting on some serious topics for me.
Yeah, and we definitely in New Zealand, we hear and consume a lot of American culture, and yeah, it was definitely a large part of our media landscape at the time when those protests were unfolding, and it did raise some questions back at home, although they weren't really questions that were as perhaps loudly asked or perhaps even mm-hmm. answered. So I was curious, you know, from your perspective as a woman and also an Indian New Zealander, if mm-hmm. we were to draw this experience you had in the US at that time back down to our local New Zealand context, you know, what kind of conversation do you feel needs to be happening in New Zealand, perhaps in the design industry itself, the design field, that is perhaps more fringe than it deserves to be? You know, is that how you look at things? Well, I'm really curious to understand like what your perspective is on the local applicability of some of the experiences that you've had over there.
Yeah, I personally think New Zealanders are ahead of the game in a lot of ways. And I definitely felt this sitting in classrooms discussing topics like decoloniality and decolonization, just reflecting back on my experience in New Zealand, being in a country that is increasingly having a bicultural identity based on the Te Tiriti. A lot of these conversations aren't even something that is acknowledged in the US. So I feel like we do have a lot of strengths in our country, and we do need to also acknowledge the positive trajectory that we are on. But at the same time, I think New Zealand is still kind of finding its feet in the sense of what does it mean to be like a super diverse country. And so, you know, obviously, like I'm a Tauiwi in New Zealand. I don't necessarily have the rule book for how do I recognize with the Te Tiriti? What is my experience as a person of color who is not, you know, not Maori? What is my relationship to the Te Tiriti, but also my relationship to the design community and how I show up in this? So there's been, I think, something that I've taken from my experience in the US is really understanding my position, my stance, and how that kind of influences the work that I do or how I show up for work in New Zealand. And I think I'm quite excited that I've been able to take time to develop that. And, you know, hopefully we'll get to approach some interesting projects in New Zealand when I get back there. So, yeah.
How do you describe that stance? What is that stance that you've now come to adopt? What does that look like?
Yeah, part of the stance comes from understanding what it means to be an Asian New Zealander and the concepts around the model minority and some of the how racism or racial inequality shows up in my community, and also what are some of the tensions between communities within communities of color themselves, right? So, you know, I don't think we can we can say that just because you're a person of color, that racism doesn't exist in your own community. So it's starting from, you know, the inside, like, you know, also I would say even starting from like the internalized racism, to like exploring like what that means for your own self as a minority in New Zealand, start from there, examine the internalized racism, and then slowly go out to the like more systemic levels of like, who are the people around you? Like, you know, how is racism showing up in those spaces? And then, you know, your organizations, your communities, your groups, and then hopefully like spread out from there. So I think there's been a lot of internal reflection on that I've done. And a lot of growth that I've done. Something that has really helped me actually is surprisingly when I showed up at Carnegie Mellon, there were so many designers who looked like me. And that was not the case when I went to design school. I was one of two brown people in my entire cohort of, I don't know how many, 400 or so designers, right? I'm often the double minority in product teams full of white men. Like that is my experience as a New Zealander, but going to America, which happens to be a very diverse country, I was able to see a lot of designers who looked like me. And at the same time, while I was doing the comparing and contrasting with them, I formed a stronger identity as a New Zealander. So I guess that would be my like insight in some ways, is like you have to leave sometimes to like actually process what your identity is. And so
I think what you're talking about there in terms of making space to ask yourself some pretty large and culturally relevant questions. Mm-hmm. And when I say you, I mean, you know, anyone to be able to help calibrate or reframe or to better yeah. understand where you are in the world and what else is at play. I think that's a really important point. I really want to quickly, before we bring the show down to a close, just touch on something that you've also been quite connected to as a result of mm-hmm. your studies and also your time at Laurel, which is this role of AI and automation and what impact it may or may not be having on our broader economy, but also perhaps more specifically, what your thoughts are on how it may come to impact us as practicing designers. You know, what is it that you've seen from your vantage point overseas and your experiences there that you feel is worthwhile others like myself thinking about in terms of how it might relate to our work and our practice?
Yeah, I have so many thoughts about AI. I guess one of them is AI is not a new thing, right? It's been around for a very long time. And I think it's easy to get caught up in the new technological hype. But at the same time, I also do think we are in a unprecedented time with the pace of AI. You know, I do think it is going to disrupt our field as designers. And we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't ignore what AI can enable in our industry in terms of increasing our productivity. But at the same time, us as designers and technology, we are going to enable AI for other people. And I think we also need to be very careful in how we do that, because it is going to be very disruptive. There's a lot I could say about AI and how it's going to impact us. But I think one of the key things is, as we develop AI, we also need to develop AI literacy, and not only for ourselves, but also for, you know, the users or the people that we design for. When I talk about AI literacy, I also mean things like accountability of where and awareness of where AI is showing up in people's lives, because it's happening in ways that are not visible as well. And so I think we're headed into a very interesting few months. Even in this year, I think we're going to see huge impacts in the design industry. So yeah, let me know which thread you want to pull if we want to discuss that more.
Well, I think what I'm noticing here is a somewhat of a theme throughout our conversation mm-hmm. of, you mentioned very early on, of you're a much slower designer now than when you left New Zealand. And you were talking earlier there about reflecting on, you know, race and its role in shaping society and how you made the space to do that. And now you're touching on this need for us to, it sounds like, be more mindful and considered in terms of how we might play a role in implementing AI as designers. And I think that's a really key theme that's coming through loud and clear for me. I have one last question that I wanted to explore with you, which is, there may be some people listening today, some designers that are thinking about moving overseas. You know, there always are people that want to go overseas, they want to experience the world. What's a piece of advice that you can share with them, or perhaps it's something that you wish you'd known before you made that move over to Pittsburgh, that if people knew now before they made the move, that they would be more successful?
Yeah, I think hold your New Zealand identity strongly would be my piece of advice. I think I realized that New Zealanders are very authentic people overall. We bring a very calm perspective from which to do critical thinking work. So I think one of my pieces of advice are, you know, stay strong to who you are as a New Zealander when you go abroad. And a lot of, you know, people who you work with really appreciate that as well. And it is a point of difference. And I think another perspective would be to realize that there's this challenge of coming from a small country. And I definitely, you know, I'm facing that tension as well as I come back to New Zealand after working at an AI startup in California. This idea of scale, you know, really does impact New Zealand. And so if you do have an opportunity to go overseas, really, you know, make the most of it and really try and experience as much as you can, because the truth is, the access to opportunities in New Zealand is a much smaller pool, and it's a different way of thinking about how to go about your career in design in New Zealand. It's very rich in its own way, but there is a plethora of opportunities out there in the big world. So I would say, you know, be open-minded in going out there and exploring that as well.
Nandini, that's a wonderful place to finish our conversation today. It's been great to spend some time with you. Thank you for sharing your stories and your insights with the New Zealand design community today.
Thanks so much, Brendan. I really enjoyed the kōrero, and thank you for doing this.
Oh, I enjoyed it too, Nans. And to our listeners, thank you for being with us on this episode of DCAST, the podcast of Toi Manaho Designers Institute of New Zealand. Keep an eye out for the next episode of Outside In No Borders. It'll be out soon, so now's a really good time to take a moment and subscribe to or follow the pod if you haven't done so already. If you've enjoyed this conversation, don't keep it all to yourself. Please don't do that. Share a link to it on your social, especially on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And when you do, tag us so that we can say thank you for passing it along. And if you're feeling really generous, give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Those are really helpful with getting this podcast out to more New Zealand designers. That's it from me. Enjoy the rest of your day.